also tell you to keep your mouth shut? Not to say a word about any of this to anyone? Of course. Above all, ran on Jason, as if he had not heard her, not to contact the police, which under the circumstances would be the most logical thing in the world to do. In some ways, the only thing to do. Yes, naturally. Not naturally, contradicted Bourne. Look, I'm just a relay. Probably not much higher than you. I'm not here to convince you. I'm here to deliver a message. We ran a test on Dolbert. We fed her false information. Janine? Monique Brielle's perplexity was compounded by mounting confusion. The things she said were incredible. As incredible as Claude's hysterical screaming. The things he said. But what she said was the opposite of what he said. We know. It was done intentionally. She's been talking to Azur. House of Azur? Check her out tomorrow. Confront her. Confront her? Just do it. It could be tied in. With what? The trap. Azur could be working with Interpol. Interpol? Traps? This is the same craziness. Nobody knows what you're talking about. Lavier knows. Get in touch with her right away. They approached the end of the block. Jason touched her arm. I'll leave you here at the corner. Go back to your hotel and call Jacqueline. Tell her it's far more serious than we thought. Everything's falling apart. Worst of all, someone has turned. Not Dolbert, not one of the clerks, but someone more highly placed. Someone who knows everything. Turned? What does that mean? There's a traitor in Les Classiques. Tell her to be careful of everyone. If she isn't, it could be the end for all of us. Bourne released her arm, then stepped off the curb and crossed the street. On the other side, he spotted a recessed doorway and quickly stepped inside. He inched his face to the edge and peered out, looking back at the corner. Monique Brielle was halfway down the block, rushing toward the entrance of her hotel. The first panic of the second shockwave had begun. It was time to call Marie.
I'm worried, Jason. It's tearing him apart. He nearly broke down on the phone. What happens when he looks at her? What must he be feeling, thinking?
He'll handle it, said Bourne, watching the traffic on the Champs-Élysées from inside the glass telephone booth, wishing he felt more confident about André Villiers. If he doesn't, I've killed him. I don't want it on my head. But that's what I'll have done. I should have shut my goddamn mouth and taken her myself.
You couldn't have done that. You saw D'Anjou on the steps. You couldn't have gone inside.
I could have thought of something. As we've agreed, I'm resourceful. More than I like to think about.
But you are doing something. You're creating panic, forcing those who carry out Carlo's orders to show themselves. Someone's got to stop the panic, and even you said you didn't think Jacqueline Lavier was high enough. Jason, you'll see someone, and you'll know. You'll get him. You will.
I hope so. Christ, I hope so. I know exactly what I'm doing, but every now and then... Bourne stopped. He hated saying it, but he had to. He had to say it to her. I get confused. It's as if I'm split down the middle. One part of me saying, save yourself. The other part... God help me. Telling me to get Carlos.
It's what you've been doing from the beginning, isn't it?
Said Marie softly. I don't care about Carlos, shouted Jason, wiping away the sweat that had broken out on his hairline, aware, too, that he was cold.
It's driving me crazy, he added,
not sure whether he had said the words out loud or to himself.
Darling, come back.
What? Bourne looked at the telephone, again not sure whether he had heard spoken words or whether he had wanted to hear them, and so they were there. It was happening again. Things were, and they were not. The sky was dark outside a telephone booth on the Champs-Élysées. It had once been bright, so bright, so blinding, and hot, not cold, with screeching birds and screaming streaks of metal. Jason!
What?
Come back. Darling, please come back.
Why?
You're tired. You need rest.
I have to reach Trignon. Pierre Trignon. He's the bookkeeper.
Do it tomorrow. It can wait until tomorrow.
No. Tomorrow's for the captains.
What was he saying?
Captains. Troops. Figures colliding in panic. But it was the only way. The only way. The chameleon was a provocateur.
Listen to me, said Marie, her voice insistent. Something's happening to you. It's happened before. We both know that, my darling. And when it does, you have got to stop. We know that, too. Come back to the hotel. Please.
Bourne closed his eyes. The sweat was drying, and the sounds of the traffic outside the booth replaced the screeching in his ears. He could see the stars in the cold night sky. No more blinding sunlight. No more unbearable heat. It had passed, whatever it was.
I'm all right. Really, I'm okay now. A couple of bad moments, that's all.
Jason. Marie spoke slowly, forcing him to listen.
What caused them?
I don't know.
You just saw the Brielle woman. Did she say something to you? Something that made you think of something else?
I'm not sure. I was too busy figuring out what to say myself.
Think, darling.
Bourne closed his eyes, trying to remember.
Had there been something?
Something spoken casually or so rapidly that it was lost at the moment?
She called me a provocateur, said Jason,
not understanding why the word came back to him.
But then that's what I am, aren't I? That's what I'm doing.
Yes, agreed Marie.
I've got to get going, continued Bourne. Trignon's place is only a couple of blocks from here. I want to reach him before 10.
Be careful.
Marie spoke as if her thoughts were elsewhere.
I will. I love you.
I believe in you, said Marie Saint-Jacques.
The street was quiet, the block an odd mixture of shops and flats indigenous to the center of Paris, bustling with activity during the day, deserted at night. Jason reached the small apartment house listed in the telephone directory as Pierre Trognon's residence. He climbed the steps and walked into the neat, dimly lit foyer. A row of brass mailboxes was on the right, each one above a small spoked circle through which a caller raised his voice loudly enough to identify himself. Jason ran his finger along the printed names below the slots. Monsieur Pierre Trognon, 42. He pushed the tiny black button twice. 10 seconds later, there was a crackling of static.
Oui?
Monsieur Trognon, s'il vous plaît.
Ici?
Télégramme, monsieur.
Je ne peux pas quitter ma bicyclette.
Télégramme? Pour moi? Pierre Trognon was not a man who often received telegrams. It was in his astonished tone. The rest of his words were barely distinguishable, but a female voice in the background was in shock, equating a telegram with all manner of horrendous disasters. Bourne waited outside the frosted glass door that led to the apartment house interior. In seconds he heard the rapid clatter of footsteps growing louder as someone, obviously Trognon, came rushing down the staircase. The door swung open, concealing Jason. A balding, heavy-set man, unnecessary suspenders creasing the flesh beneath a bulging white shirt, walked to the row of mailboxes, stopping at number 42.
Monsieur Trognon?
The heavy-set man spun around, his cherubic face set in an expression of helplessness.
A telegram? I have a telegram, he cried. Did you bring me a telegram?
I apologize for the ruse, Trignon, but it was for your own benefit. I didn't think you wanted to be questioned in front of your wife and family.
Questioned?
Exclaimed the bookkeeper, his thick, protruding lips curled, his eyes frightened.
Me? What about? What is this? Why are you here at my home? I'm a law-abiding citizen.
You work in Saint-Honoré? For a firm called Les Classiques?
I do. Who are you?
If you prefer, we can go down to my office, said Bourne.
Who are you?
I'm a special investigator for the Bureau of Taxation and Records, Division of Fraud and Conspiracy. Come along. My official car is outside.
Outside? Come along. I have no jacket, no coat. My wife, she's upstairs expecting me to bring back a telegram. A telegram!
You can send her one if you like. Come along now. I've been at this all day and I want to get it over with.
Please, monsieur, protested Trignon. I do not insist on going anywhere. You said you had questions. Ask your questions and let me go back upstairs. I have no wish to go to your office.
It might take a few minutes, said Jason.
I'll ring through to my wife and tell her it's a mistake. The telegram's for old Gravet. He lives here on the first floor and can barely read. She will understand.
Madame Trignon did not understand, but her shrill objections were stilled by a shriller Monsieur Trignon.
There, you see,
said the bookkeeper, coming away from the mail slot, the strings of hair on his bald scalp matted with sweat.
There's no reason to go anywhere. What's a few minutes of a man's life? The television shows will be repeated in a month or two. Now what in God's name is this, monsieur? My books are immaculate, totally immaculate. Of course I cannot be responsible for the accountant's work. That's a separate firm. He's a separate firm. Frankly, I've never liked him. He swears a great deal, if you know what I mean. But then who am I to say?
Twignon's hands were held out, palms up, his face pinched in an obsequious smile. To begin with, said Bourne, dismissing the protestations, do not leave the city limits of Paris. If for any reason, personal or professional, you were called upon to do so, notify us. Frankly, it will not be permitted.
Surely you're joking, monsieur.
Surely I'm not.
I have no reason to leave Paris, nor the money to do so. But to say such a thing to me is unbelievable. What have I done?
The Bureau will subpoena your books in the morning. Be prepared.
Subpoena? For what cause? Prepared for what?
Payments to so-called suppliers whose invoices are fraudulent. The merchandise was never received, was never meant to be received. The payments instead routed to a bank in Zurich.
Zurich? I don't know what you're talking about. I've prepared no checks for Zurich.
Not directly, we know that. But how easy it was for you to prepare them for non-existent firms. The money's paid, then wired to Zurich.
Every invoice is initialed by Madame Lavrier. I pay nothing on my own.
Jason paused, frowning. Now it's you who are joking, he said.
On my word. It's the house policy. Ask anyone. Les Classiques does not pay a sou unless authorized by Madame.
What you're saying, then, is that you take your orders directly from her.
But naturally.
Whom does she take orders from?
Trignon grinned. It is said from God, when not the other way around. Of course, that's a joke, monsieur.
I trust you can be more serious. Who are the specific owners of Les Classiques?
It is a partnership, monsieur. Madame Lavier has many wealthy friends. They have invested in her abilities. And, of course, the talents of René Bergeron.
Do these investors meet frequently? Do they suggest policy? Perhaps advocate certain firms with which to do business?
I wouldn't know, monsieur. Naturally. Everyone has friends.
We may have concentrated on the wrong people, interrupted Bourne. It's quite possible that you and Madame Lavier, as the two directly involved with the day-to-day finances, are being used.
Used for what?
To funnel money into Zurich, to the account of one of the most vicious killers in Europe. Trignon convulsed, his large stomach quivering as he fell back against the wall.
In the name of God, What are you saying?
Prepare yourselves, especially you. You prepared the checks, no one else.
Only upon approval.
Did you ever check the merchandise against the invoices?
It's not my job.
So in essence, you issued payments for supplies you never saw.
I never see anything. Only invoices that have been initialed. I pay only on those.
You'd better find every one. You and Madame Lavier had better start digging up every backup in your files, because the two of you, especially you, will face the charges.
Charges? What charges?
For a lack of a specific writ, let's call it accessory to multiple homicide.
Multiple?
Assassination. The account in Zurich belongs to the assassin known as Carlos. You, Pierre Trignon, and your current employer, Madame Jacqueline Lavier, are directly implicated in financing the most sought-after killer in Europe. Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, alias Carlos. Trignon slid down to the foyer floor, his eyes in shock, his puffed features twisted out of shape.
All afternoon, he whispered. People running around, hysterical meetings in the aisles, looking at me strangely, passing my cubicle and turning their heads. Oh, my God!
If I were you, I wouldn't waste a moment. Morning will be here soon, and with it, possibly the most difficult day of your life. Jason walked to the outside door and stopped, his hand on the knob. It's not my place to advise you, but if I were you, I'd reach Madame Lavier at once. Start preparing your joint defense. It may be all you have. A public execution is not out of the question. The chameleon opened the door and stepped outside, the cold night air whipping across his face. Get Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is for Charlie and Delta is for Cain.
False.
Find a number in New York. Find Treadstone. Find the meaning of a message. Find the sender. Find Jason Bourne. Sunlight burst through the stained glass windows as the clean-shaven old man in the dated suit of clothes rushed down the aisle of the church in Neuilly-sur-Seine. The tall priest standing by the rack of novena candles watched him, struck by a feeling of familiarity. For a moment, the cleric thought he had seen the man before, but could not place him. There had been a disheveled beggar yesterday, about the same size, the same... No, this old man's shoes were shined, his white hair combed neatly, and the suit of clothes, although from another decade, were of good quality.
Angelus Domini, said the old man as he parted the curtains of the confessional booth.
Enough, whispered the silhouetted figure behind the scrim. What have you learned in Saint-Honoré?
Little of substance, but respect for his methods.
Is there a pattern?
Random, it would appear. He selects people who know absolutely nothing and instigates chaos through them. I would suggest no further activity at Les Classiques.
Naturally, agreed the silhouette. But what's his purpose?
Beyond the chaos, asked the old man. I'd say it was to spread distrust among those who do know something. The Brielle woman used the words. She said the American told her to tell Lavier there was a traitor inside, a patently false statement. Which of them would dare? Last night was insane, as you know. The bookkeeper, Trignon, went crazy. Waiting until 2 in the morning outside Lavier's house, literally assaulting her when she returned from Brielle's hotel, screaming and crying in the street. Lavier herself did not behave much better. She was barely in control when she called Parc-Monceau. She was told not to call again. No one is to call there, ever again. Ever. We received the word. The few of us who know the number have forgotten it. Be sure you have.
The silhouette moved suddenly, There was a ripple in the curtain.
Of course, to spread distrust. It follows chaos. There's no question about it now.
He'll pick up the contacts, try to force information from them, and when one fails, throw him to the Americans and go on to the next. But he'll make the approaches alone. It's part of his ego. He is a madman. And obsessed.
He may be both, countered the old man, but he's also a professional.
He'll make sure the names are delivered to his superiors in the event he does fail. So regardless of whether you take him or not, they will be taken.
They will be dead, said the assassin.
But not Bergeron. He's far too valuable. Tell him to head for Athens. He'll know where.
Am I to assume I'm taking the place of Parmenceau?
That would be impossible. But for the time being, you will relay my final decisions to whomever they concern.
And the first person I reach is Bergeron.
To Athens.
Yes. So Lavier and the colonial, d'Anjou, are marked then?
They are marked. Bait rarely survives, and they will not. You may also relay another message to the two teams covering Lavier and d'Anjou. Tell them I'll be watching them all the time. There can be no mistakes.
It was the old man's turn to pause, to bid silently for attention.
I've saved the best for last, Carlos. The Renault was found an hour and a half ago in a garage in Montmartre. It was brought in last night.
In the stillness, the old man could hear the slow, deliberate breathing of the figure beyond the cloth.
I assume you've taken measures to have it watched, even now at the moment, and followed. Even now, at the moment?
The once bespoken beggar laughed softly.
In accord with your last instructions, I took the liberty of hiring a friend with a sound automobile. He in turn has employed three acquaintances, and together they are on 4 6-hour shifts on the street outside the garage. They know nothing, of course. Except that they are to follow the Renault at any hour of day or night. You do not disappoint me. I can't afford to. And since Parmenceau was eliminated, I had no telephone number to give them but my own, which, as you know, is a run-down café in the quarter. The owner and I were friends in the old days, the better days. I could reach him every 5 minutes for messages, and he would never object. I know where he got the money to pay for his business, and whom he had to kill to get it. You've behaved well. You have value. I also have a problem, Carlos. As none of us are to call Parmenceau, how can I reach you? In the event I must. Say, for instance, the Renault.
Yes, I'm aware of the problem. Are you aware of the burden you ask for?
I would much prefer not to have it. My only hope is that when this is over and Cain is dead, you will remember my contributions, and rather than killing me, change the number.
You do anticipate.
In the old days, it was my means of survival.
The assassin whispered 7 figures.
You are the only man alive who has this number. Naturally, it is untraceable.
Naturally? Who would expect an old beggar to have it?
Every hour brings you closer to a better standard of living.
The net is closing. Every hour brings him nearer to one of several traps.
Cain will be caught, and an impostor's body will be thrown back to the bewildered strategists who created him. They counted on a monstrous ego, and he gave it to them. At the end, he was only a puppet,
an expendable puppet. Everyone knew it but him.
Bourne picked up the telephone. Yes?
Room 420?
Go ahead, General.
The telephone calls have stopped.
She is no longer being contacted. Not at least by telephone.
Our couple was out and the phone rang twice. Both times she asked me to answer it. She really wasn't up to talking.
Who called?
The chemists with a prescription and a journalist requesting an interview.
She couldn't have known either. Did you get the impression she was trying to throw you off by having you take the calls? Failures paused, his reply laced with anger.
It was there. The effect less than subtle insofar as she mentioned she might be having lunch out. She said she had a reservation at the George Sank, and I could reach her there if she decides to go.
If she does, I want to get there first.
I'll let you know.
You said she's not being contacted by phone. Not at least by telephone, I think you said. Did you mean something by that?
Yes. 30 minutes ago, a woman came to the house. My wife was reluctant to see her, but nevertheless did so. I only saw her face for a moment in the parlor, but it was enough. The woman was in panic.
Describe her. Villiers did.
Jacqueline Lavier, said Jason. I thought it might be. From the looks of her, the wolf pack was eminently successful. It was obvious she had not slept. Before taking her into the library, my wife told me she was an old friend in a marriage crisis. A fatuous lie. At her age, there are no crises left in marriage, only acceptance and extraction.
I can't understand her going to your house. It's too much of a risk. It doesn't make sense. Unless she did it on her own, knowing that no further calls were to be made.
These things occurred to me, said the soldier. So I felt the need of a little air, a stroll around the block. My aide accompanied me. A doddering old man taking his limited constitutional under the watchful eye of an escort. But my eyes, too, were watchful. Lavier was followed. Two men were seated in a car 4 houses away, the automobile equipped with a radio. Those men did not belong to the street. It was in their faces, in the way they watched my house.
How do you know she didn't come with them?
We live on a quiet street. When Lavier arrived, I was in the sitting room having coffee and heard her running up the steps. I went to the window in time to see a taxi drive away. She came in a taxi. She was followed.
When did she leave?
She hasn't, and the men are still outside.
What kind of car are they in?
Citroën. Grey. The first 3 letters of the license plate are N-Y-R.
Birds in the air, following a contact. Where do the birds come from?
I beg your pardon?
What did you say? Jason shook his head. I'm not sure. Never mind. I'm going to try to get out there before Lavier leaves. Do what you can to help me. Interrupt your wife. Say you have to speak with her for a few minutes. Insist her old friend stay. Say anything. Just make sure she doesn't leave.
I will do my best.
Bourne hung up and looked at Marie, standing by the window across the room. It's working. They're starting to distrust each other. Lavier went to Parc Monceau and she was followed. They're beginning to suspect their own.
Birds in the air, said Marie. What did you mean?
I don't know. It's not important. There isn't time.
I think it is important, Jason.
Not now. Bourne walked to the chair where he had dropped his top coat and hat. He put them on quickly and went to the bureau, opened the drawer, and took out the gun. He looked at it for a moment, remembering. The images were there, the past that was his whole, yet not his whole at all. Zurich, the Bahnhofstrasse and the Carillon du Lac, the dry Alpenhauser and the Löwenstrasse, a filthy boarding house on the Steppdeckstrasse. The gun symbolized them all, for it had once nearly taken his life in Zurich. But this was Paris, and everything started in Zurich was in motion. Find Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. False. God damn you, false. Find Treadstone. Find a message. Find a man. Chapter 29. Jason remained in the far corner of the back seat as the taxi entered Villiers Block in Parc Monceau. He scanned the cars lining the curb. There was no gray Citroën, no license with the letters NYR. But there was Villiers. The old soldier was standing alone on the pavement, four doors away from his house. Two men. In a car, four houses away from my house. Villiers was standing now where that car had stood. It was a signal.
Arrêtez, s'il vous plaît, said Bourne to the driver. Le vieux là-bas. Je veux parler avec lui.
He rolled down the window and leaned forward.
Monsieur?
In English, replied Villiers, walking toward the taxi, an old man summoned by a stranger. What happened? Asked Jason.
I could not detain them.
Them?
My wife left with the Lavier woman. I was adamant, however. I told her to expect my call at the Georges V. It was a matter of the utmost importance, and I required her counsel.
What did she say?
That she wasn't sure she'd be at the Georges V, that her friend insisted on seeing a priest in Neuilly-sur-Seine, at the Church of the Blessed Sacrament. She said she felt obliged to accompany her.
Did you object?
Strenuously. And for the first time in our life together, she stated the thoughts in my own mind. She said, if it's your desire to check up on me, André, why not call the parish? I'm sure someone might recognize me and bring me to a telephone.
Was she testing me? Bourne tried to think. Perhaps. Someone would see her there, she'd make sure of it. But bringing her to a phone might be something else again. When did they leave?
Less than 5 minutes ago. The two men in the Citroën followed them.
Were they in your car?
No. My wife called a taxi.
I'm going out there, said Jason.
I thought you might, said Villiers. I looked up the address of the church.
Bourne dropped a 50-franc note over the back of the front seat. The driver grabbed it. It's important to me to reach Neuilly-sur-Seine as fast as possible. The Church of the Blessed Sacrament. Do you know where it is?
But of course, monsieur. It is the most beautiful parish in the district.
Get there quickly and there will be another 50 francs.
We shall fly on the wings of blessed angels, monsieur.
They flew, the flight plan jeopardizing most of the traffic in their path.
There are the spires of the Blessed Sacrament, monsieur, said the victorious driver 12 minutes later, pointing at three soaring towers of stone through the windshield. Another minute, perhaps two, if the idiots who should be taken off the street will permit.
Slow down, interrupted Bourne, his attention not on the spires of the church, but on an automobile several cars ahead. They had taken a corner, and he had seen it during the turn. It was a gray Citroën. Two men in the front seat. They came to a traffic light. The cars stopped. Jason dropped the second 50-franc note over the seat and opened the door. I'll be right back. If the light changes, drive forward slowly and I'll jump in. Bourne got out, keeping his body low, and rushed between the cars until he saw the letters. NYR. The numbers following were 768, but for the moment they were inconsequential. The taxi driver had earned his money. The light changed and the row of automobiles lurched forward like one elongated insect pulling its shelled parts together. The taxi drew alongside. Jason opened the door and climbed in. You do good work, he said to the driver.
I'm not sure I know the work I am doing.
An affair of the heart. One must catch the betrayer in the act.
In church, monsieur?
The world moves too swiftly for me.
Not in traffic, said Bourne.
They approached the final corner before the Church of the Blessed Sacrament. The Citroën made the turn, a single car between it and a taxi, the passengers indistinguishable. Something bothered Jason. The surveillance on the part of the two men was too open, far too obvious. It was as if Carlos' soldiers wanted someone in that taxi to know they were there. Of course. Villiers' wife was in that cab, with Jacqueline Lavier. And the two men in the Citroën wanted Villiers' wife to know they were behind her.
There is the Blessed Sacrament, said the driver, entering the street where the church rose in minor medieval splendor in the center of a manicured lawn, crisscrossed by stone paths and dotted with statuary.
What shall I do, monsieur?
Pull into that space, ordered Jason, gesturing at a break in the line of parked cars. The taxi with Villiers' wife and the Lavier woman stopped in front of a path guarded by a concrete saint. Villiers' stunning wife got out first, extending her hand for Jacqueline Lavier, who emerged ashen on the pavement. She wore large orange-rimmed sunglasses and carried a white purse, but she was no longer elegant. Her crown of silver-streaked hair fell in straight, disassociated lines down the sides of her death-white mask of a face, and her stockings were torn. She was at least 300 feet away, but Bourne felt he could almost hear the erratic gasping for breath that accompanied the hesitant movements of the once regal figure stepping forward in the sunlight. The Citroën had proceeded beyond the taxi and was now pulling to the curb. Neither man got out, but a thin metal rod, reflecting the glare of the sun, began rising out of the trunk. The radio antenna was being activated. Codes sent over a guarded frequency. Jason was mesmerized, not by the sight and the knowledge of what was being done, but by something else. Words came to him, from where he did not know, but they were there. Delta to Almanac, Delta to Almanac. We will not respond. Repeat, negative, brother. Almanac to Delta. You will respond as ordered. Abandon, abandon. That is final. Delta to Almanac. Your final, brother. Go fuck yourself. Delta out. Equipment damaged. Suddenly the darkness was all around him, the sunlight gone. There were no soaring towers of a church reaching for the sky. Instead, there were black shapes of irregular foliage shivering beneath the light of iridescent clouds. Everything was moving. Everything was moving. He had to move with the movement. To remain immobile was to die. Move. For Christ's sake, move. And take them out. One by one. Crawl in closer. Overcome the fear, the terrible fear, and reduce the numbers. That was all there was to it. Reduce the numbers. The monk had made that clear. Knife, wire, knee, thumb. You know the points of damage. Of death. Death is a statistic for the computers. For you, it is survival. The monk. The monk? The sunlight came again, blinding him for a moment, his foot on the pavement, his gaze on the gray Citroën 100 yards away. But it was difficult to see. Why was it so difficult? Haze. Mist. Not darkness now, but impenetrable mist. He was hot. No, he was cold. Cold. He jerked his head up, suddenly aware of where he was and what he was doing. His face had been pressed against the window. His breath had fogged the glass. I'm getting out for a few minutes, said Bourne. Stay here.
All day, if you wish, monsieur.
Jason pulled up the lapels of his topcoat, pushed his hat forward, and put on the tortoiseshell glasses. He walked alongside a couple toward a religious sidewalk bazaar, breaking away to stand behind a mother and child at the counter. He had a clear view of the Citroën. The taxi, which had been summoned to Parc Monceau, was no longer there, dismissed by Villiers' wife. It was a curious decision on her part, thought Bourne. Cabs were not that available. 3 minutes later, the reason was clear and disturbing. Hillier's wife came striding out of the church, walking rapidly, her tall, statuesque figure drawing admiring glances from strollers. She went directly to the Citroën, spoke to the men in front, then opened the rear door. The purse. A white purse. Villiers' wife was carrying the purse that only minutes before had been clutched in the hands of Jacqueline Lavier. She climbed into the Citroën's back seat and pulled the door shut. The sedan's motor was switched on and gunned, prelude to a quick and sudden departure. As the car rolled away, the shiny metal rod that was the vehicle's antenna became shorter and shorter, retracting into its base. Where was Jacqueline Lavier? Why had she given her purse to Villiers' wife? Bourne started to move, then stopped, instinct warning him. A trap? If Lavier was followed, those following her might also be trailed, and not by him. He looked up and down the street, studying the pedestrians on the sidewalk, then each car, each driver and passenger, watching for a face that did not belong, as Villiers had said of the two men in the Citroën had not belonged in Parc Monceau. There were no brakes in the parade, no darting eyes or hands concealed in outsized pockets. He was being overly cautious. Neuilly-sur-Seine was not a trap for him. He moved away from the counter and started for the church. He stopped. His feet suddenly clamped to the pavement. A priest was coming out of the church, a priest in a black suit, a starched white collar, and a black hat that partially covered his face. He had seen him before. Not long ago, not in a forgotten past, but recently. Very recently. Weeks, days, hours, perhaps. Where was it? Where? He knew him. It was in the walk, in the tilt of his head, in the wide shoulders that seemed to glide in place above the fluid movement of his body. He was a man with a gun. Where was it? Zurich? The Carillon du Lac? Two men breaking through the crowds, converging, brokering death. One wore gold-rimmed glasses. It was not he. That man was dead. Was it that other man in the Carillon du Lac? Or in the Gison Key? An animal, grunting, wild-eyed in rape. Was it he? Or someone else? A dark-coated man in the corridor at the Auberge de Croix, where the lights had been shorted out, the spill from the staircase illuminating the trap. A reverse trap where that man had fired his weapon in darkness at shapes he thought were human. Was it that man? Bourne did not know. He only knew that he had seen the priest before, but not as a priest, as a man with a gun. The killer in the priestly dark suit reached the end of the stone path and turned right at the base of the concrete saint, his face briefly caught in the sunlight. Jason froze. The skin. The killer's skin was dark, not tanned by the sun, but by birth. A Latin skin, its hue tempered generations ago by ancestors living in or around the Mediterranean, forebears who migrated across the globe, across the seas. Bourne stood paralyzed by the shock of his own certainty. He was looking at Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez. Get Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is for Charlie and Delta is for Cain. Jason tore at the front of his coat, his right hand grasping the handle of the gun in his belt. He started running on the pavement, colliding with the backs and chests of strollers, shouldering a sidewalk vendor out of his way, lurching past a beggar digging into a wire trash. The beggar. The beggar's hand surged into his pocket. Bourne spun around in time to see the barrel of an automatic emerge from the threadbare coat, the sun's rays bouncing off the metal. The beggar had a gun. His gaunt hand raised it, weapon and eyes steady. Jason lunged into the street, careening off the side of a small car. He heard the spits of the bullets above him and around him, piercing the air with sickening finality. Screams, shrill and in pain, came from unseen people on the sidewalk. Bourne ducked between two automobiles and raced through the traffic to the other side of the street. The beggar was running away. An old man with eyes of steel was racing into the crowds, into oblivion. Get Carlos. Trap Carlos. Cain is... Jason spun again and lurched again, propelling himself forward, throwing everything in his path out of his way, racing in the direction of the assassin. He stopped, breathless, confusion and anger welling in his chest, sharp bolts of pain returning to his temples. Where was he? Where was Carlos? And then he saw him. The killer had climbed behind the wheel of a large black sedan. Bourne ran back into the traffic, slamming hoods and trunks as he threaded his way insanely toward the assassin. Suddenly he was blocked by two cars that had collided. He spread his hands on a glistening chrome grille and leaped sideways over the impacted bumpers. He stopped again, his eyes searing with pain at what he saw, knowing it was pointless to go on. He was too late. The large black sedan had found a break in the traffic, and Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez sped away. Jason crossed back to the far pavement as the shrieking of police whistles turned heads everywhere. Pedestrians had been grazed or wounded or killed. A beggar with a gun had shot them. Javier! Bourne broke into a run again, back toward the Church of the Blessed Sacrament. He reached the stone path under the eye of the concrete saint and spun left, racing toward the arched, sculptured doors and the marble steps. He ran up and entered the Gothic church, facing racks of flickering candles, fused rays of colored light streaming down from the stained glass windows high in the dark stone walls. He walked down the center aisle, staring at the worshippers, looking for streaked silver hair and a mask of a face laminated in white. The Lavier woman was nowhere to be seen, yet she had not left. She was somewhere in the church. Jason turned, glancing up the aisle. There was a tall priest walking casually past the rack of candles. Bourne sidestepped his way through a cushioned row, emerged on the far right aisle and intercepted him. "Excuse me, Father," he said. "I'm afraid I've lost someone." "No one is lost in the house of God, sir," replied the cleric, smiling. "She may not be lost in spirit, but if I don't find the rest of her, she'll be very upset. There's an emergency at her place of business." "Have you been here long, Father?"
"I greet those of our flock who seek assistance, yes. I've been here for the better part of an hour."
Two women came in a few minutes ago. One was extremely tall, quite striking, wearing a light-colored coat and I think a dark kerchief over her hair. The other was an older lady, not as tall, and obviously not in good health. "Did you by any chance see them?" The priest nodded.
"Yes. There was sorrow in the older woman's face. She was pale and grieving."
"Do you know where she went?" "I gather her younger friend left."
"A devoted friend, may I say. She escorted the poor dear to confession, helping her inside the booth. The cleansing of the soul gives us all strength during the desperate times."
"To confession?"
"Yes. The second booth from the right. She has a compassionate father confessor, I might add. A visiting priest from the Archdiocese of Barcelona. A remarkable man, too. I'm sorry to say this is his last day. He returns to Spain..."
The tall priest frowned.
"Isn't that odd? A few moments ago I thought I saw Father Manuel leave. I imagine he was replaced for a while. No matter. The dear lady is in good hands."
"I'm sure of it," said Bourne. "Thank you, Father. I'll wait for her." Jason walked down the aisle toward the row of confessional booths, his eyes on the second, where a small strip of white fabric proclaimed occupancy. A soul was being cleansed. He sat down in the front row, then knelt forward, angling his head slowly around so he could see the rear of the church. The tall priest stood at the entrance, his attention on the disturbance in the street. Outside, sirens could be heard wailing in the distance, drawing closer. Bourne got up and walked to the second booth. He parted the curtain and looked inside, seeing what he expected to see. Only the method had remained in question. Jacqueline Lavier was dead. Her body slumped forward, rolled to the side, supported by the prayer stall, her mask of a face upturned, her eyes wide, staring in death at the ceiling. Her coat was open, the cloth of her dress drenched in blood. The weapon was a long, thin letter opener, plunged in above her left breast. Her fingers were curled around the handle, her lacquered nails the color of her blood. At her feet was a purse. Not the white purse she had clutched in her hands 10 minutes earlier, but a fashionable Yves Saint Laurent, the precocious initials stamped on the fabric, an escutcheon of the haute couture. The reason for it was clear to Jason. Inside were papers identifying this tragic suicide. This overwrought woman so burdened with grief she took her own life while seeking absolution in the eyes of God. Carlos was thorough. Brilliantly thorough. Bourne closed the curtain and stepped away from the booth. From somewhere high in a tower, the bells of the morning Angelus rang splendidly. The taxi wandered aimlessly through the streets of Neuilly-sur-Seine, Jason in the back seat, his mind racing. It was pointless to wait, perhaps deadly to do so. Strategies changed as conditions changed, and they had taken a deadly turn. Jacqueline Lavier had been followed, her death inevitable but out of sequence. Too soon. She was still valuable. Then Bourne understood. She had not been killed because she had been disloyal to Carlos, rather because she had disobeyed him. She had gone to Parc Monceau. That was her indefensible error. There was another known relay at Les Classiques, a gray-haired switchboard operator named Philippe d'Anjou, whose face evoked images of violence and darkness and shattering flashes of light and sound. He had been in Bourne's past, of that Jason was certain, and because of that, the hunted had to be cautious. He could not know what that man meant to him. But he was a relay, and he too would be watched, as Lavier had been watched, additional bait for another trap, dispatch demanded when the trap closed. Were these the only two? Were there others? An obscure, faceless clerk, perhaps, who was not a clerk at all but someone else. A supplier who spent hours in Saint-Honoré legitimately pursuing the cause of haute couture, but with another cause far more vital to him. Or her. Or the muscular designer, René Bergeron, whose movements were so quick and fluid. Bourne suddenly stiffened, his neck pressed back against the seat, a recent memory triggered. Bergeron. The darkly tanned skin, the wide shoulders accentuated by tightly rolled-up sleeves, shoulders that floated in place above a tapered waist, beneath which strong legs moved swiftly like an animal's, a cat's. Was it possible? Were the other conjectures merely phantoms, compounded fragments of familiar images he had convinced himself might be Carlos? Was the assassin, unknown to his relays, deep inside his own apparatus, controlling and shaping every move? Was it Bergeron? He had to get to a telephone right away. Every minute he lost was a minute removed from the answer, and too many meant there would be no answer at all. But he could not make the call himself. The sequence of events had been too rapid. He had to hold back, store his own information. "The first telephone booth you see, pull over," he said to the driver, who was still shaken by the chaos at the Church of the Blessed Sacrament.
"As you wish, monsieur. But if monsieur will please try to understand, it is past the time when I should report to the Fleet Garage. Way past the time."
"I understand."
"There's a telephone."
"Good. Pull over." The red telephone booth, its quaint panes of glass glistening in the sunlight, looked like a large dollhouse from the outside and smelled of urine on the inside. Bourne dialed the terrasse, inserted the coins, and asked for room 420. Marie answered.
"What happened?"
"I haven't time to explain. I want you to call Les Classiques and ask for René Bergeron. D'Anjou will probably be on the switchboard. Make up a name and tell him you've been trying to reach Bergeron on Lavier's private line for the past hour or so. Say it's urgent. You've got to talk to him.
When he gets on, what do I say?
I don't think he will, but if he does, just hang up. And if D'Anjou comes on the line again, ask him when Bergeron's expected. I'll call you back in 3 minutes.
Darling, are you all right?
I've had a profound religious experience. I'll tell you about it later. Jason kept his eyes on his watch, the infinitesimal jumps of the thin, delicate sweep hand too agonizingly slow. He began his own personal countdown at 30 seconds, calculating the heartbeat that echoed in his throat as somewhere around 2.5 per second. He started dialing at 10 seconds, inserted the coins at 4, and spoke to the Taras's switchboard at -5. Marie picked up the phone the instant it began to ring. "What happened?" he asked. "I thought you might still be talking."
"It was a very short conversation. I think D'Anjou was wary. He may have a list of names of those who've been given the private number. I don't know. But he sounded withdrawn, hesitant."
"What did he say?"
"Monsieur Bergeron is on a fabric search in the Mediterranean. He left this morning and isn't expected back for several weeks."
"It's possible I may have just seen him several hundred miles from the Mediterranean."
"Where?"
"In church." "If it was Bergeron, he gave absolution with the point of a very sharp instrument."
"What are you talking about?"
"Lavier's dead."
"Oh my God. What are you going to do?"
"Talk to a man I think I knew. If he's got a brain in his head, he'll listen. He's marked for extinction." Chapter 30 D'Anjou.
Delta. I wondered when. I think I'd know your voice anywhere. He had said it. The name had been spoken. The name that meant nothing to him, and yet somehow everything. D'Anjou knew. Philippe D'Anjou was part of the unremembered past. Delta. Cain is for Charlie, and Delta is for Cain. Delta. 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 He had known this man, and this man had the answer. Alpha, Bravo, Cain, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot. Medusa. Medusa, he said softly, repeating the name that was a silent scream in his ears. Pierce is not Tom Juan, Delta. There are no debts between us any longer. Don't look for payment. We work for different employers now. Jacqueline Lavier's dead. Carlos killed her in Rue Sur Seine less than 30 minutes ago. Don't even try. As of 2 hours ago, Jacqueline was on her way out of France. She called me herself from Orly Airport. She's joining Bergeron. On a fabric search in the Mediterranean? Interrupted Jason. D'Anjou paused. The woman on the line, asking for René. I thought as much. It changes nothing. I spoke with her. She called from Orly. She was told to tell you that. Did she sound in control of herself? She was upset, and no one knows why better than you. You've done a remarkable job down here, Delta. Or Cain, or whatever you call yourself now. Of course she wasn't herself. It's why she's going away for a while. It's why she's dead. You're next. The last 24 hours were worthy of you. This isn't. She was followed. You're being followed. Watched every moment. If I am, it's for my own protection. Then why is Lavier dead? I don't believe she is. Would she commit suicide? Never.
Call the rectory at the Church of the Blessed Sacrament in Rue Sur Seine. Ask about the woman who killed herself while taking confession. What have you got to lose? I'll call you back. Bourne hung up and left the booth. He stepped off the curb, looking for a cab. The next call to Philippe D'Anjou would be made a minimum of 10 blocks away. The man from Medusa would not be convinced easily, and until he was, Jason would not risk electronic scanners picking up even the general location of the call.
Delta, I think I'd know your voice anywhere.
Paris is not Tom Kwan. Tom Kwan. Tom Kwan. Tom Kwan. Kane is for Charlie, and Delta is for Kane.
Medusa! Stop it. Do not think of things that you cannot think about. Concentrate on what is.
Now, you.
Not what others say you are. Not even what you may think you are.
Only the now. And the now is a man who can give you answers. We work for different employers.
That was the key.
Tell me. For Christ's sake, tell me, who is it? Who is my employer, d'Anjou?
A taxi swerved to a stop perilously close to his kneecaps. Jason opened the door and climbed in. Place Vendôme, he said, knowing it was near Saint-Honoré. It was imperative to be as close as possible to put in motion the strategy that was rapidly coming into focus. He had the advantage. It was a matter of using it for a dual purpose. D'Anjou had to be convinced that those following him were his executioners. But what those men could not know was that another would be following them. The Vendôme was crowded as usual, the traffic wild as usual. Bourne saw a telephone booth on the corner and got out of the taxi. He went inside the booth and dialed Les Classiques. It had been 14 minutes since he had called from Neuilly-sur-Seine.
D'Anjou? A woman took her own life while at confession. That's all I know.
Come on. You wouldn't settle for that. Medusa wouldn't settle for that.
Give me a moment to put the board on hold.
The line went dead for roughly 4 seconds. D'Anjou returned.
A middle-aged woman with silver and white hair, expensive clothing, and a Saint Laurent purse.
I've just described 10,000 women in Paris. How do I know you didn't take one, kill her, make her the basis of this call?
Oh, sure. I carried her into the church like a Pietà, blood dripping in the aisle from her open stigmata.
Be reasonable, d'Anjou.
Let's start with the obvious. The purse wasn't hers. She carried a white leather handbag. She'd hardly be likely to advertise a competing house.
Lending credence to my belief, it was not Jacqueline Lavier.
Lends more to mine. The papers in that purse identified her as someone else. The body will be claimed quickly. No one touches Les Classiques.
Because you say so?
No. Because it's the method used by Carlos in 5 kills I can name.
He could. That was the frightening thing.
A man is taken out. The police believe he's one person, the death an enigma, killers unknown. Then they find out he's someone else, by which time Carlos is in another country, another contract fulfilled. Lavier was a variation of that method, that's all.
Words, Delta. You never said much, but when you did, the words were there.
And if you were in Saint-Honoré 3 or 4 weeks from now, which you won't be, you'd see how it ends.